record this, and I will send you a transcript, and that way you can make corrections, additions, take things out, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'll edit it first, which makes we'll make sure that we're all speaking in complete sentences and things like that. So
the intent ultimately is then to have these tapes and then repositories.
Yes. The first step is to put all of these in our archives, the tapes, the transcript. There'll be release forms that you have control over who has access to it. And hopefully then we'll take the next step, which is to try and synthesize something from this material. And I've already got some things that are, I've already developed a tentative framework on how to hang a specific innovative result. I talked to John France at Monsanto, who did Roundup, and Vladimir Hensel, who was involved in platforming for UOP.
Yeah, I know Vladimir quite well. Yeah, he's up at UMass then.
Right.
Yeah. You got there to interview him?
Yes, I was up there in October. So what I'm trying to do is see if I can have some kind of framework in which to hang each of these individual developments. And again, as I said earlier, to look at what factors were in play as they took part, because it does differ from place to place. But what I'd like to begin with is some of your early background. And I know you were born on the 28th of February, 1933, in Norton, Mass. Could you tell me a little bit about your family background, your father and mother?
We lived in that area for a short time, and then we moved from there to Lowell, Mass. So I don't recall much of anything of Norton, because I was just a few years old when we moved to Lowell. Both my mother and father were Polish, although they were born here in the United States. And they suffered through the Depression periods of time. And my father worked for a gas company. He had a high school education, but he was in charge of a gas manufacturing from coal to make gas. And I remember his operating a whole panel of equipment at that time for that particular process. And so they struggled through the Depression. My father had lost his job in near Norton, Mass. So we moved to Lowell, and once we got us to Lowell, there was a job there. My mother's background was just she had a high school education. She was one of about seven or eight in the family, and my father was one of 10 or 12, large families in both cases. And so I grew up in Lowell, which is north of Boston, and went through grammar school and then through high school there in Lowell. So my whole initial background is there. One sister was about 4 years younger than I was, and all of her bringing up was there in Lowell, Mass. I'm not sure there was any great events that I can recall in those days, except that when you live in Lowell, which is in that area, you get dumped on a lot of snow and that. And I guess the only really significant event in that area was when I eventually got into high school. I decided that, I ought to do something significant in high school. So I said, why don't I graduate first in my class? It'd be a good thing to do. And I'm not sure it was that well organized. So I set us to do that, and that's what happened. So, did want to put enough perseverance. And I made a class about 650, so that wasn't too bad, actually, for that. I played musical instruments. I was playing the band, and had a few other things that we did in school, the science clubs and things of that area. But I think also noteworthy was probably that my first exposure to chemistry was there in high school. Probably one of the most outstanding teachers in that area. Very challenging and motivating, and since I did well at it, I figured, gee, that's something that might want to continue.
Is this teacher Richard Conway?
You had that from someplace?
You filled out a form for us.
Oh, yeah.
Mention his name.
Yeah, really very challenging, unusual person in that regard. And it was a good experience for me.
Did you have a good lab experience with that, too?
I found that I was better out of the lab a lot of times than I was in the lab in terms of manipulative skills. It wasn't that I was there, but there were people better than that. Even I certainly understand sort of the principles and that. So I ended up graduating there in 1950 in high school. Okay, and so I was very highly motivated there. And when I went to college, I went to Boston University. And
why did you select BU as opposed to Northeastern or any of the other schools in the Boston area?
I don't know. When I finished high school, I wasn't sure what I really wanted to do. And even though I had graduated very high in my class, I actually didn't go to college right away. I worked for about 6 months. I wasn't sure what I wanted to really do and anything. So when I decided to go back in, it's tough in the middle of a semester to get in the year to get in. And then I had an opportunity at Boston University, so I said, well, gee, I'll go there. And then I was, so it was kind of it was at loose ends for a while. And I did go back to Boston University, and I did all right in college, and I didn't have the same motivation as I did in high school. I'm not sure. I guess I was going through a period where I wasn't sure what I really wanted to do, and so I was going through kind of an identity crisis sometime, maybe. So I ended up 4 years at Boston University, and I did okay, but there was nothing outstanding, I would say.
You majored in chemistry?
I majored in chemistry at that time, and I guess about the thing I remember most that when I was there was all those 4 summers I worked up at Boston University. They had a summer camp up in Peterborough, New Hampshire. I don't really know that area up around that way. And there's a part of Boston University which is called Sargent College, and it's a girls' part thing. And they have summer camp up there. I remember my thrills for working up there in the summer. I'd say that I went through there. I did all right, but I really didn't have the motivation for some reason. I'm not even sure I understand today that I had in high school, because I really wasn't sure what I ultimately wanted to do. I just didn't know. And unlike where in high school, I had a goal, I wanted to do something. And so when I finished college in 54, that was just at the end of the Korean War, and a whole bunch of us knew each other, enlisted in the service, where you go in, you had to stay only 2 years, but rather than wait to get called, because they were calling people, we just went and enlisted, we figured we'd get it over with. And so I spent 2 years in the service from 54 till 56, and I was over in Germany during that time. I recall that in 4 or 5 months before I was getting out of service, I said, gee, I got to figure out what I'm going to do my life. And so I had inquired to a number of companies where I would go for whether they had openings and so forth. And so I interviewed here at Carbide back in 56. Not at this location. We had another facility in Bloomfield, New Jersey, which is north of here, about 30 so miles. And I interviewed several companies and all, and I got a very nice offer. I thought it was a nice offer at the time from Carbide. It certainly wasn't the facilities or anything, because they had the worst facilities of the whole bunch at that time. It was really an old building. But I liked the people I met and all, and I recall that the salary offer I got at that time was $435 a month. I said, gee, that's kind of nice. And I took that, and it was very significant because I worked for a fellow when I first came in who I thought I really liked and who just beginning in a whole new area of chemistry and is really launched off where I ultimately ended up on this because it's the area that's known in the industry as the zeolitic catalysis. And discoveries were just being made at that time when I was just beginning. And I did some work in the laboratories from that time. I got very interested in the areas and all. I had just a bachelor's degree at that time. And so I worked there for a couple of years, and I got married in 1958. My wife's the same wife I have today, and from Massachusetts. And so she came down here in 58, and I was working there. And then I thought, gee, maybe I ought to go to graduate school, because I thought the opportunities would be better, and I felt I needed some additional background in science. So we had one child, married and all. We decided in 1959 go to graduate school. So I left Carbide in 59, and I got a position. Graduate student up at MIT. It was a good little spot for us because we were from Boston. My wife would be close to her family and my child and stuff. And so I worked up there in physical organic chemistry for a fellow named Swain. Gardner Swain. Who was at that time was doing some very important physical organic chemistry. Lots of controversy and stuff with regard to I worked in an area that when I first got the assignment, we talked about it was in an area of statistical thermodynamics, which is really in the physical chemistry department. I'm in the organic chemistry department. Swain said, well, you don't really have the background to do this project. I said, I'll learn this project, okay? So I took a project on isotope effects in graduate school, doing a lot of theoretical calculations and calculating partition functions, which at that time I knew nothing about. So I really worked extremely hard in learning, getting through the organic chemistry as well as the physical one. Plus, I was out of school for a number of years because I had worked and been in the service. So I was a little bit of a shock when I just saw the challenge that was there. And I think that really launched me because I got very interested in that particular area. I learned a lot from graduate students and working in that environment. And so I finished up when I went back. I have a wife, I had one child, and another child when we were there. So there was some motivation to not linger around too long in graduate school. So one of my motivations was to get my project done, but also to get back out of there, get a degree, learn what I can. And so I got out from MIT in 2 years and 9 months, which was reasonably fast, I would think. I graduated from there in 62, and as I said, I did all of the work in a whole area of statistical thermodynamics and chemistry. I decided where I'm going to come to work. And since I'd worked previously at Carbide, I went and I interviewed a number of other companies at the same time, but I did decide to come back to Carbide. I guess the main reason is I liked the kind of work I had been doing, and I liked the fellow that I was working with, and it looked like there'd be some nice opportunities there. So I came back in 1960-62, and I worked in some areas that were a little bit unrelated to where I ultimately ended up, but I was doing work in catalysis, in polymerization catalysis in that regard.
Was that what you had been doing in the first 3 years you were here? Were you in catalysis?
I've been at Carbide here, I've been in catalysis of one type or another my whole career.
Okay.
At Carbide. And I worked on a number of areas of catalysis, but not in polyolefin catalysis, which is what I had worked with before.
Okay.
Excuse to them. And it was just at the time that Cabide was a big producer of polyethylene. We were one of the ones that were running high-pressure routes to make polyethylene. And we've gotten involved in low-pressure routes. We were, at that time, originally a licensee of Phillips Petroleum, about the time that I'm coming back into the program. And it was, Cabide was interested in low-cost processes and new routes for making polyethylene. And we had some engineering people who had been fooling around a little bit with gas phase processes. And it's kind of where the setting I'm in at that time. And we started out then, when I got involved, and I would work in the fringe areas, then I got involved in polyethylene. We started out to develop proprietary catalyst technology. And initially, there's a certain amount of resistance. You got a licensing from somebody else, a certain amount of comfort index there to come in and bring new systems in is kind of a challenge. And so I worked from 64 and 65 on some proprietary systems. We had made some progress in that area. And I got transferred into another area of catalysis because I needed somebody over there. So here I am back in the area, and then I get transferred out, and I worked in some other areas of free radical chemistry. And I assumed that I would not ever be back in polyolefins. But we had some reorganizations about a year or two later, and the fellow I had originally worked with wanted me back into that area. He said, "You gotta come back in this area." And then I went back with a small group of people. And this is now 1967, 68. And we launched a series of catalytic programs to develop a variety of proprietary catalysts that could be run in our units. And then what we did was the process we used was a solvent process. And there's this emerging gas phase process coming up. And what we did was to merge the catalytic technology we had with this new process we had, was the gas phase process of translating catalysts into that process for making what was known at that time as high density polyethylene. You know the difference between high density? Okay.
Could I ask a question about the gas phase process?
Yes.
Because if I'm correct, up to this point, almost all of it was solution
and slurry processes. Yes.
And was it Carbide who made the decision to go into gas phase to look at the gas phase process?
Yes. Yeah. We decided that the impetus. There was a fellow who I personally had not met, but who said that gee, Carbide ought to somehow get involved in the lowest cost process. High pressure processes run at 20,000 to 30,000 psi, 200 to 300 degrees centigrade, very expensive to build. Why don't you get rid of all of that and try to look at that gas phase? Why don't you guys do that kind of thing? It's kind of the business challenge for somebody out there. So that's kind of the setting. I think the important feature is there's a receptivity at a level to kind of do some of this kind of thing as a radical kind of thing. And we had, and some of this work is being done down in Charleston, West Virginia, some of the process work, doing the catalyst work. And we tested out varying catalysts. We try to find out what would make them work in gas phase. No solvent here, you got a heterogeneous catalyst making a polymer. The process basically consists of taking solid catalyst particles, putting them in a reactor, growing polyethylene on these catalyst particles up to a certain size, and so forth. And I'll talk more about that. I just want to capture the sense of the challenge of, say, you toss it in the gas phase, sounds simple, but there's lots of challenges. So we developed several catalysts for high-density polyethylene, and we were able to demonstrate that they could are run under commercial conditions, where commercial conditions means the catalyst residues are so low in the product you never even take the catalyst residues out, which means your productivity has got to be about close to 1 million pounds of polymer per pound of transition metal. And typical transition metals at that time were chromium, and subsequently there was others, but at that time. And we're up here now, and we're talking about the period of 1968 to about 1971. We're doing this kind of work for high-density polyethylene. And we're beginning to look at the possibility of licensing this technology to other people. And we had an affiliate in Sweden, and we had an affiliate in Australia who were we actually licensed this, and they were actually running this at the same time. So what you see emerging is a licensing concept as opposed to us doing everything ourselves.
But was this licensing new for carbide, or had they done this before?
Because in the past, the idea, you know, there was a whole concept, if you've got something like that, you keep it yourself, you just don't go out and license it. And there's a whole interplay going on at this point that relates to, is this something we should or shouldn't do? And so the first entree is to do a little bit with affiliates at this time. Now, all of this stuff going on up to this point really is dealing with what we call high-density polyethylene. It's really not attacking the major area of high-pressure polyethylene, which is known as low-density polyethylene, which is billions of pounds of material. But what we did establish was that a gas-phase process can be credible for making some polyethylene. Now, the challenges in just making polyethylene is you just don't make polyethylene isn't like acetone or something like that, speed molecule. It can be a whole variety of things. It has a molecular weight, it has a molecular weight distribution. You've got to make the right molecular weight, the right molecular weight distribution. Normally, you copolymerize ethylene with alpha olefins such as propylene, butene to get some branching along the chain, but only a little bit. And all of these have to be dialed into the catalyst so that the catalyst does all of these things. So there's a whole variety of challenges to make that happen, because when you're running the gas phase, you're normally running about 80 to 100 degrees centigrade. And if you're up much higher than 100 degrees, the whole bed will set up and glomerate. So that even when you're running, you have to be careful that the reaction doesn't run away on you, because you end up with an agglomerate that can be 20,000 pounds or 100,000 pounds. There's challenges of getting it out of the reactor. So there's a lot of challenges of that type. But again, all of this is dealing with an arena where we haven't, where we've got credibility for the gas phase, but we haven't applied the gas phase to go after the high pressure materials, which has more branching, is got in the polymer chain, and there's a set of properties associated with high pressure as opposed to high-density polyethylene. And we started a program in 71 or 72, where we said, we know gas phase works, let's find out what it takes to do this under low pressure and go after and attack this huge market. And it's an interesting thing for carbide, because we're a big producer of high pressure polyethylene, and we're going and attacking in a way our own technology, because we're the leading producer of this, and we're saying, hey, we're going to go and replace all this technology, which I think in the history of science is kind of an interesting perspective. Normally you have another company that might go and attack your technology or another thing. Here's a case where we're actually going after and attacking our own high-pressure technology. And we had facilities, all over the United States, many, many reactors, some in Puerto Rico, here in the U.S., and so forth. So there's some people that are watching us all along, because they want to figure out, is this really going to happen? And there's really some doubts as to whether this is really going to happen. Can you even if you run it and make it, will the properties be satisfactory?
Who was involved in making these decisions?
Which decision?
Well, I mean, so it's a business decision. It's a research decision. It's a business decision. And at what level were they being made, and who was the champion of the cause?
Okay. Clearly, in an effort of this type, in order to make anything happen, you got to have people at the top of the carbide to do this. Some of the people that I interfaced with, particularly remember, was John Luxinger, who was at that time an operations manager. I'm back here in about 1968, when we're putting in our first gas phase reactor in a commercial unit. And I recall John as being the business operations manager spokesman for that area. And I think that he certainly championed this cause to the hilt. It was a significant risk at that point in terms of just demonstrating the credibility of the process. And then the second part is, where are you going to do with this process in terms of the kinds of product opportunities? So he was involved. And there were several other people in the organization at the operations manager level. But as I said, the one I interfaced with in terms of providing the business perspective from my point of view was John Luxinger at that time. And his challenge to us was, this is what we want to do, and we can figure out how to do it, and what is the mechanism by which we're going to use, because
this kind of a program, we have lab people, we have product people, we have process people, we got plant people, and the secret of this thing is to integrate all of these things so they all kind of work together. And one of the things I've always felt very strongly about is that in research that we do, we need to constantly interface and be a part of the process, part of the product, part of the thing. So I think part of my role on this was in discovering and inventing these catalysts, but also the catalytic systems, but also working with the process and product and manufacturing people in terms of establishing credibility for this, in terms of translating the technology from the lab through this process. So when new people come in and they work with us, one of the things they don't have is an exposure to this kind of thing. And part of my role is to be sure that people have this kind of education.
It's interesting because you have a variety of different people that are working, and with some people there's an attitude, gee, if we do the basic research, then implementation is trivial, and they need remedial training. We have to teach them that that isn't the case, and that a significant part of the success of any project is not that you understand the detailed chemistry, but you can take care of it in terms of translating that into process, into commercial operations. That's what I call innovation, is the translating of the inventions that are being made into commercial reality. And I'm struck with over the years, is how we do this, I think, pretty quite well now. But at the beginning, there's a whole period of having to do this and getting manufacturing, even talk to R&D people. And I think that those hurdles in this area, at least, are not a problem of any type, but they were something that had to be incorporated in terms of this.
So we have a business climate that says, hey, we want to do this kind of things, and then we have various people which that way. And my role was to work with the catalyst people in terms of developing the technology, and then to interface with the product and process people in terms of being able to show them how to use this and how to translate that. And clearly, there's lots of people involved in this kind of thing. There's engineering, there's product and all. We kind of look at it as though the reactor provides the economics and the catalyst provides the product opportunities in the reactor. It's kind of like this. And our philosophy has been to look at a variety of different catalysts. You know, any one catalyst can take an awful lot of time to develop and study, but if you get hung up on any one system, you find that you don't have as much flexibility as you like. So our philosophy was to, if we run into a stalemate with any one piece of catalyst technology, we're going to look at another one. So we've always carried several catalyst systems, too, because they provide flexibility, their structure and their formulation play an important role in the end project. So anyway, we set off back in the 70s to try to make products for high-pressure polyethylene, and we worked with certain chromium catalysts. And we were able to identify a chromium-based catalyst that made some attractive high-pressure polyethylenes. But the materials that we made were satisfactory for certain special applications in what we call the wire and cable area. And the big thing in high-pressure polyethylenes is having the capability of making products that will fit, that will fall into the film arena. And the catalysts that we had were not satisfactory for doing that. So we did develop this chromium-based technology. We did show that you could make in the gas phase reactor some of these products. So we've kind of made a step forward. We've gone from high-density polyethylene into low-density polyethylene, but we haven't quite gotten where we want to be. We want some technology, a catalyst technology, that'll make replacements for the high-pressure thing, because we use the gas-based process, the economics are so much better, and so forth. So we set out on another research program, another looking for another catalytic system. We do that, and we demonstrate we're successful in doing that with this new system in about 1977. Okay, we found some technology that allowed us to make products that looked as though they would be very competitive with high pressure. And we made an announcement, chairman of the board, we made announcements going all the way up to the chairman of the board, that we had been successful in being able to demonstrate in a gas-phase process that you could make products equivalent, and some of the properties of the material were actually superior to the materials that were there. This creates a huge new revolution, beginning revolution, because now you have high-pressure reactors all over the world making this the materials. And carbide coming along and saying in 1977 we can do this via low pressure process with better economics in terms of investment and operating costs. At the same time, we made a conscious decision to license this technology in a serious way around to people. I mentioned earlier that the person who I interfaced most with was John Luxinger. The person who is involved here after John was a fellow named Bill Joyce, and I became quite aware of Bill and his whole business involvement in this area in around 1975-76, and he has been the major spearhead, the business champion of this technology from that time on. And Bill at that time was an operations manager, and today he's the chief operating officer at Union Carbide. Bill was able to see this technology, its vast potential in terms of being able to really replace a significant amount of high pressure, recognize that carbide didn't have the financial resources to put in all this investment themselves in these reactors, and spearheaded a major licensing effort at Union Carbide to license this technology. And one of our very first licensees of this technology, the first one for this was Exxon, which was very significant. And we've gone, and subsequently and Mobil, and today there's licensees all over the world. I mean, there's many, many reactors. It's trouble keeping up with the actual statistics and numbers on these things, but it is the major process in the world today for making what's known as linear low-density polyethylene. The process is licensed in all parts of the world. I guess the way I look at it is, in a way, the sun never really sets on these reactors. I mean, we're in Australia, today we're in China, Japan, Saudi Arabia, Russia, South America, Canada, a number of places in Europe. And the advantages of this was that this process has got such improved economics. It's easy to run. It's environmentally friendly. There's no solvents around. It's under very mild conditions. When you think about it, you're running this thing instead of 20,000-30,000 PSI, you're running this at 100 to 200 PSI as one pressure. Partial pressure, and instead of 250-300 degrees, you're running this at 80-90 degrees. And I think there's got to be 15 to 20 billion pounds of this somewhere in this vicinity being produced around the world today. There's been a huge development since the discoveries in 77 and so forth that we could make these products, and what's happened is the market, the share, if you look at high density polyethylene, really hasn't grown much at all, maybe shrunk a bit. But we have captured about, I think in the United States, it's close to 50% of a multi-billion pound market for producing polyethylene. Now, the detailed structure of these products that we make have some improvements versus high pressure,
But there's still some improvements you can still make to capture more and more of the market. So there's a fair amount of effort that continues to go on to continue to develop and improve on the on this process of manufacturing. So for carbide, it's been, I guess, it all goes starts from way back with the original discoveries, you know, with Zeeb and that, our involvement, and our continuous involvement in this area for a lot of years. I think it's involved a significant management commitment at the top to let us go and do the kinds of things we wanted to do, because there's no way you're going to do this kind of thing without support. And I think there's been some unusual leadership, particularly with Bill Joyce since 77. And I don't know what I mentioned to you, but a year or two ago, he got the National Medal of Technology for the business leadership in the program. So I've been involved for a lot of years in this area, training. And I guess I look at it several things. One is training people in terms of how to do catalysis work, how to interface, discovering new systems, and learning how to translate them as quickly as possible. I think our cycle for evolving technology from the lab, process, product, and going around that cycle in terms of identifying what's important, bringing it to management's attention, and a receptivity from management to do that kind of thing. I think it's a unique combination of things that will come together, in this kind of thing. Now, in all of the fragments and the pieces that are here to talk to you, there's lots of challenging technical features to this kind of thing, and certainly we could talk forever on that. But that's kind of the general flow of what's occurred. I might mention that a recent extension of this technology has been the ability for us to take this technology and not only make these types of materials, but also now entering into the rubber area of making rubbers such as EPR and EPDM, which you can feel, if you look at it, there's significant challenges because the material is such a sticky type of material with lots of agglomeration issues and so forth. There was a belief a long time that that couldn't occur, but that is an extension of this technology that we're now pursuing, and that looks promising.
There's an interesting chart here.
Yeah, yes it is.
This is figure, 29 in your...
That's the ACS
right. Award address.
Mm-hmm.
And...
this is very good. This captures a lot of
it. It really summarizes things very interestingly. It's almost like you're using a catalyst to dial in the set of properties you want.
Right, the molecular configurations that you're trying to get in, we think that we know as well as anybody today how to dial these in. What's needed when you make high-density polyethylene, what are the kinds of structures you need, and what is the catalyst requirements. Our entree into linear low-density polyethylene, where in essence what we're doing is we're putting more branching, and branching means that you add an alpha olefin such as butene or hexene to the system, and there's a linear low density area, and then there's a fleximer area which as you drive the density down you get materials that have unusual flexibility used in hosing, tubing, things of that nature, with flexibility, particularly good geomembranes and all. And then what we did was, while we were working in this area, we wanted to get involved in polypropylene by a gas phase. We've made high density and linear low, so I want to get into polypropylene. Well, since we hadn't been in polypropylene, but we knew we had a process that would make also, we felt would make tractor polypropylene gas phase. We had a collaborative effort with Shell Chemical in terms of wetting our sources in this area, where they would provide a certain perspective in certain areas. And we formed a joint venture and demonstrated that polypropylene could be produced. Originally, Shell brought the catalyst, we brought the process. And then we both jointly worked in terms of an improved catalytic system that makes a wider spectrum of polypropylenes. And there's a unit that makes, I think, around 200 million pounds of polypropylene down at Cedra. And we also elected to license this technology as well. And we have a significant number of licensees of the technology here. So just like we have in high density some licensees in linear low, there's another licensing program that deals with producing polypropylene. So here we are here on this end of the spectrum here, and then we felt that we ought to learn what are the requirements to also make EPR, EPDM. Where here the challenge is from a process point of view, how do you run a process where a resin is intrinsically sticky at a low temperature? How do you run a viable process? And we developed technology and a unit is in the process of being built, I think sometime for 96, where we think we have attractive products of EPR, ethylene propylene rubber, and EPDM, ethylene propylene tholine or guanine tripolymer, which is, and this termonymer is used to provide cross linking, which is important in a lot of rubber applications. And so we see ourselves as having the capability of doing this. It's unusual for us that the process configuration is there, and we've found ways to adjust the process, and then we've dialed in with the catalyst here. Now, I might say a little more about the catalyst here. There's a set of requirements for the catalysts that you have to meet this way. And the first one is got to be high productivity. All the catalysts got to be high productivity. And in the polyethylene area and polypropylene area, as I said earlier, that's down to a few parts per million or less of a transition metal. The transition metals typically are things like titanium, chromium, sometimes perhaps vanadium. Secondly, you have to make the right molecular weight. So you have to have dialed in the catalyst, the capability of adjusting molecular weight. The catalyst also has to make the right kind of molecular weight distribution. Some applications for polyethylene polypropylene demand a narrow molecular weight distribution, and other applications demand a broad molecular weight distribution. And generally, the catalyst and the nature of the catalyst that you produce provides the capability of making narrow or broad distribution, and we have technologies to do those. The catalyst also has got to be able to introduce comonomer, because frequently you need catalysts that put in branching, butene, hexene, and various catalysts depending on their structure can determine how much branching you can put into the polymer. Some catalysts are good at it, some are bad, are not as good, and we know what factors control there. The catalyst morphology is important. Typically, you have catalyst particles that might be around 30 to 50 microns, and typically what you have is a catalytic species put on a substrate, and the substrates that people typically use are substrates like silica. And there's a way of formulating the catalyst on the silica. And so these particles that are around 30 to 40 microns during the polymerization convert into a polymer, produce polymer, and the polymer particles are around 500 to 1,000 microns in size. Now that's important because you're fluidizing this bed in a gas-phase fluidized reactor. the size of this particle, the shape, and all very important because
they determine all the dynamics of fluidization.
And so it's not a trivial factor to do this kind of thing. Usually the polymer particle is about 15 to 20 times larger than the catalyst particle during the growth process. And in addition, the catalyst particle at the end has to be fragmented. So during the process, we literally blow apart the catalyst particles.
Polymerization takes place into the particles, and you fracture these 30 micron particles into fragments that are less than 1 micron. Now that's very important for us because if these catalyst particles didn't fragment, first they wouldn't be very active, and secondly these fragments would appear in the polymer as discrete gels. You could visually see them and so forth. And so there's a whole technology of using the right kind of supports to get this kind of a factor and to blow these particles apart. And there's literally many, many man years that go into the whole science of doing this kind of a thing. So that's very important to be competitive. So the end result is you need to do all those things, high productivity, molecular weight distribution, morphology, and you got to do it with catalysts that aren't very expensive. If the catalyst costs a lot of money, like if it were to contribute a few cents per pound to the cost of polyethylene, it's too expensive. You've got to be down around a penny or less per pound of polyethylene. So you've got to do all of those things with something that's simple. And not only simple, but reproducible. You know, in catalyst systems, you know, they sometimes we want to misbehave on you. And so we have to learn and be conscious of the economics of this kind of thing at the same time. So that's important.
When you started doing catalysis work in the 60s, how much of it was on a firm scientific basis and how much of it was, I don't want to say black magic, but an art of just screening large numbers of materials and seeing if they would work to give the properties you wanted in the polymer?
This whole area was so new that, and if you kind of go back to the excitement of the original discoveries, surprise to everyone that any of this stuff even occurred at room temperature and atmospheric pressure, because the only background is of that. So there was an amazement, a huge amount of just running stuff to find out just where this was applicable and all. And out of that thing, there starts to emerge a picture of what's important. We did a lot of kinetic studies. We did a lot of analytical studies to try to understand what are the fundamental principles and mechanisms of polymerization. Now, the mechanism of polymerization is still debated today, and people hold symposium and meet discoveries from back in. But I think it has emerged through all of this period of time a understanding of some of the principles of what's going on. This technology is called coordination polymerization, and in the developments, it was recognized that certain oxidation states of the metal were important. A lot of it came out of empirical work, and then you have starting to emerge some organometallic chemistry to support the principles that you're evolving. So it was one of proposing something. This is what I think is going on based on a lot of empirical stuff, checking that mechanism out with various things and building and evolving the model. You look today at where the state of the art is here in 1994, 1995, and where some of the newer systems are going. There's emerged a lot of computational chemistry that's going on. There's lots of modeling, computer modeling going on around the site. And I think there is a feeling that a lot of the things that were done empirically through the old organometallic chemistry is much better understood today. Okay. But clearly there was a bank of technology that just had a lot of these catalysts, in fact the majority of them were heterogeneous. And there's a reluctance for a lot of people to really feel that you can learn a lot about heterogeneous catalysts why don't we work, as opposed to homogeneous, that in solution you can do well-defined studies. And I think what's evolved over a period of time is a lot of supporting organometallic chemistry that provides an interpretive perspective on a lot of what was going on in cyclonic catalysis. So it's grown, but clearly when we were doing this in the 60s, there was a lot of empirical work. But I think the thing we did was we said, this is our model. Let's check this out against some things and have that guide our experiments and refine the model. It was the philosophical approach that we took during that time.
To the early days, how did you go about testing a catalyst?
As to how its credibility?
Yes.
Okay.
Its effectiveness.
We have laboratory reactors here that are 1 liter reactors, in which. We typically use something like hexane as a diluent. We would prepare the catalyst and we would react it in this 1 liter autoclave at a few hundred pounds pressure and at an 80 to 100 degrees. And we would make about 100 to 200 grams of polymer. And what we would do is we would screen a lot of reaction variables, effects of supports, catalyst loading, promoters, and so forth. And we have certain property indicators we would look at. There's terms such as melt index, which is an indication of molecular weight, and we measure the melt index. We would measure it under several different conditions, and we get a feel for what the molecular weight distribution was. And we measure the density. The key thing we were looking for at that time is what kind of molecular weight distribution did it make, what kind of melt index did it make, and is it highly active? Now, the battle you face in the laboratory, which is a significant one, is impurities. You're dealing with ethylene, you're dealing with trace amounts of catalyst. Frequently you make runs and nothing happens. Many runs, nothing happens. You make a run with a trace more catalyst and it will roar away on you and you agglomerate. And one of the findings in this area was that the impurities and the control of that are very critical. In fact, in our production facilities today, as a result of a lot of this work, is we have rigorously controlled feedstream purity, where the levels of impurities are down to parts per million. Okay. So there's a constant battle in the laboratory doing runs. When we had something was credible, which means we thought it was fairly active in the laboratory and it looked as though it met some of the needs, we would take it to our pilot plant and we would produce larger quantities of catalysts. A pilot plant to us meant that you're making about 20 to 50, 60 pounds an hour of polymer in a reactor. And these are, we we started off with just one little reactor then, and today we have seven or eight power plant reactors that run around the clock almost every day of the year.
And we would test that under steady state conditions, control conditions, and make pounds of material in the order of hundreds of pounds of material. We'd study the process features of that, and then and the facility we're doing this is in Charleston, West Virginia. And typically, the chemists would go and work with them. Product would come back here to Bolingbrook, which is where our product testing was, and we do a product testing. And they would say, yeah, some things are good, but some things aren't good, or something, nothing's good and bad, you need to go back to drawing board and go through the cycle. One thing I found, which I think was important, is our philosophy was that there's certain things you can learn in the laboratory, but you need to go to the bigger scale unit to learn what other problems. You want to work on the, I think the philosophy,
the point I'm trying to make is you want to work on the right problems. And one of the time, and the right problems in a lot of cases aren't all that obvious based on just plain laboratory work. So we try to do what we can, and over the years we've learned that there's some things that are better done in a reactor. Studying factors such as agglomeration and operability and so forth better than in those units. So our philosophy is to move things quickly through the units to establish just how the overall thing prepared. We started off with just a couple of autoclaves in the laboratory, and we have over 20 or so just little batch reactors here. And we have our pilot plants down in West Virginia, and we also have catalyst manufacturing facilities here where we want to make larger batches of catalysts. We can make them here and test them out in our laboratory to show they're okay, and then they can get shipped down. So there's a whole protocol that got evolved out of this kind of thing. But the main initial evaluating thing for catalysts is these batch reactors. We use them both to support our pilot activities as well as to do basic research on new catalysts that we think would be promising in the future. And that's kind of the protocol.
Your primary function was the catalyst, developing the catalyst. Is that correct?
My responsibility was to define catalysts and to work collaboratively with the pilot plant and the product people to be sure that the technology that we were aware of was effectively done in the pilot plant, and the product evaluations that end up being carried out, we understand what the deficiencies are because so that we can go back and dial in. So I think the key thing here is this interplay here, because if we discover something and we wait for somebody else to come and ask us, gee, this thing, we'll never get anywhere. So part of my role is to create the awareness and to guide the efforts of the technology as it goes along, as well as to create the motivational environment today and the perspective of what should be done. There's so much things, so many things and catalysts can be done, that you got to be selective in doing things that have some relevant meaning.
The reason I asked that question is that I know of several examples where once the basic discovery was made, that individual was no longer involved, and it fell to a whole new part of it, a whole new team to work up the technology and going from bench scale to commercialization.
Well, I think there's an overlap. I think what I'm trying to get at is that when we translate things, let's take a situation. We have a catalyst here that we want to scale up in the pilot plant. What do? We get together with the pilot people. We talk to them about this. We tell them what we've observed. And we'll have one or two of our people participate in pilot trials where the run is done by the pilot plant people, but with the perspective of our knowledge. Now, we have to now find out whether the product's any good. And so what we tried to do, and so these materials are good as a product, the catalyst people are involved in the extent that they need to understand what the deficiencies are here, because the product people say, gee, this is not right for this or that. There's an iteration. There's an iteration between the product people and process, and there's also an iteration of product people and catalyst people so that they can go and change things around. Now, that is an important iteration for the success of this thing. If each of these units were working independently, we kind of look at it as a collaborative effort when well as individual ones here. And I think the other thing is the business setting is such that this is being actively encouraged. The idea of continuing of rolling, what I call rolling over resources, is built into our whole business strategy. That when we moved resources from high density into linear low, then we moved them from linear low into polypropylene and then EPR. And there's a whole support basis for doing this kind of thing. So that's kind of
where we are. And when people take things into the plant, there are run teams, there are technology managers and all. And so there's a whole variety of new people who come in into this kind of a thing. But we don't abdicate our responsibility that if there's a catalyst problem that exists in the plant, that we shouldn't worry about it. I mean, because the technology is such a nature that all of those things, this is a problem with the overall process features, this process feature. So we have run teams that go and do this thing under business business sponsorship. So we know there's business managers, operations managers, and all. There's a whole folio of this thing. And what I was trying to get at is the technical responsibility when we hand something to the power plant doesn't end. It's basically the power plant.
I'm wondering if we could go back a little bit. I want to try to get some dates and some times in the framework that I'm not, some places okay. I'm not quite sure of. But I have one question about BU, if I could go back that far.
Okay.
Was Lyman Newell there when you were there?
Lyman Newell.
Newell, there's a building named after him.
He was involved in the history of chemistry. There was a room which had a history of chemistry collection.
The names I recall.
I don't know if he was alive at that.
Yeah, that's
time.
The point I was trying to make. This I'm there in 1950 to 54, and the word Newell Library sticks in my mind. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
he was very heavily involved in the history of chemistry and had quite a collection. And I have.
Oh really?
As an aside, I were trying to determine what's happened to it, and we don't know.
I was on the board there, not the board, alumni board there, in the chemistry department. The fellow that's the chairman of the department, at least a year or so ago, was Guilford Jones.
Oh yes.
And he rediscovered me, I guess, in a way. When I went to Perkin Metal, he asked me to come up and talk with them, and I gave lectures and so forth, and I ended up with kind of renewing some acquaintances from way back. Arno Hein was there. I don't really know Arno. He was in the analytical one. They've been here a lot of years. And Gil Jones and Norman Lichten. And so I have renewed acquaintances up there, but I think it's only through the library is the name.
Apparently what's happened is a lot of it was put in boxes someplace, and we're not sure what happened beyond that. So I was just curious if you had any... Did they have a history of chemistry course when you were there?
I don't recall that.
Okay. In that, you had two papers published with Carrick. Is that
Wayne
right?
Carrick, yeah.
Wayne Carrick. At the time that you were at MIT, and I assume those came out of the work you had done in that first 3 year period, you also indicated he was an influential person in your life.
Yes. He was my first supervisor. Here I am, I'm coming in, just come out of the service. I graduated from Boston University. It was just the beginning of zygomatic telesis. And he gave me an initial assignment to kind of look at something. And I got interested in an area which is called copolymerization, that I read on the thing. And I got fascinated with that and the capabilities of that way back at that time. And so I worked in studying copolymerization and studying a lot of the rules of the game in that regard. And Wayne was very supportive of the work we were doing at that time. And we were very interested in what makes these catalysts work, what are the factors that work. And a lot of the publications that came out focused on methods to probe the nature of the active site. It was a very stimulating environment. It's kind of an interesting, it's an old, dilapidated building. I mean, it was really not much of a facility, no air conditioning, two, three-man laboratories, not very much room, no elaborate cafeteria or anything like that. But there was an environment of excitement at that time because it was really emergence of organic chemistry, and that really would drove a number of us to want to work with that. And we thought we were finding out a lot of things and looked at that time as though we might even have had a catalyst of our own way back at that time. For me, coming out was a nice environment. I kind of had a lot of freedom to do some things, and I worked very hard at that time. I remember coming in evenings and stuff and working. Wayne was there and we had discussions. So it was a very stimulating environment. Probably the reason why I came back to Carbide. I'm certain it's the reason I came back to Carbide, because I had better offers other places. Mm-hmm. And I worked well together at that time.
It almost sounds like an academic environment in some sense.
It had a lot of that. I guess we weren't worrying very much at that time about a lot of the business. It was more one, geez, this is interesting stuff, let's do it. it was just very open at that time. Carbide was already already in high pressure polyethylene from way back during that book. So I just, anything we're doing in polyethylene at that time was okay. The company was had a lot of, a lot of money. Things were going well. We had freedom to do this. We never really dwelt much on budgets, as I recall. At least I wasn't exposed to very much of that. And we were pretty excited about what we were learning at that point. And I hated to even leave, because I left, I'm doing this work, and I thought it was being very productive, and I decided to leave in 1959 to go back to graduate school. So I hated to leave that area. And then when I came back, I was asked whether I wanted to work in several other areas, which was perceived by management at that time perhaps as more important than what I'd been doing before. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. So I don't think I could get back. And again, it was a relationship that did that, for sure, in my case.
Yes, because then when you came back, well, in 72, you had two more papers on chromosine catalyst.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask about the attitude of Carbide towards publishing papers at that time. And did that attitude change in later years?
Well, there's the whole issue of proprietary technology. I guess what we did was we had developed the chromosine catalyst. We had filed and received some U.S. patents on it. we thought we had some very important things to say about it. And so what we did was we wrote the thing up and we submitted them and gave justification for why we wanted to do this, and it was received favorably. I think, so generally my attitude is that if there's something that is protected with patents and so forth, and it looks like it's an important contribution, you go through the effort of putting it together and submitting it. I think a lot of times people don't want to go through that effort, and I think frequently if you go through that effort and people can actually see what the document is as opposed to some vague proposal, it helps that way. I found it's a fantastic learning tool for me personally to do that, because I find out what we really know. So I, even if it didn't get published, I had an important learning experience in that regard. I think part of my role has been to be a spokesman for technology at Union Carbide. And the talents is something we're very proud. This is the most important arena in all of Union Carbide in terms of its importance. We license technology, and I think it's important for us, for people that are involved in the technology, to represent the ACE. I think it's good for licensing, and I think it's good for the individual personally in that regard. So my philosophy, again, regarding this is there are various attitudes about, should we or shouldn't publish. What I have done is, when I think there's something that ought to be said, I put it together and submit it, and say, gee, this would be okay, and this is covered under these things, and we go through a dialogue as to how much proprietary stuff is in there. And so I've, over the years, given a huge number of presentations around the world, national meetings. I think it's a good thing to do, and I think, but it's a privilege that, in a way, one abuses in a sense of getting into situations where you disclose it prematurely and so. That's been my attitude, and that was the attitude in 72. Here's some stuff, we think it's good, we're proud of it. Here, this is what the papers are, and some papers. We do this, most of my writing on what papers, I never do here at work, I do it at home. I have a bunch of things there. A long sustained period of quiet time. This is the only way I can write a paper. I don't like to spend a half hour on it. I never get anything done, get into a train of thought. So that's been my attitude about it. Put it together, let somebody take a look at it.
You've followed the research ladder, as it were, at Carbide. And a couple of questions about that. But before I do, was there ever a thought of moving into a management side of the company?
I looked at that, and what I was concerned about was that I might get removed from technology, which is, I think, an important strength I have. Now, I've had a group working with me all the way back since 1968. It's varied in size. I've had a few people up to, at one time, as much as 15 or so PhDs, something of that order, that way. And it's varied from one to another. So I guess, in a way, I'm not sure whether I'm a traditional scientist or a manager with a scientist hat or what. But right now, we have a number of people work with me. There's an administrative organization, and then there's a functional organization, and I have a lot of interface with regard to kinds of programs that ought to go on and everything through the pilot plant product and the various where they're at. So, as well as some line responsibility. So I guess I'm a scientist manager or manager scientist, depending on how you look at it. I've always worked with, at least since way back, in 68 or so, some people working with me. I don't know what you want to call it. As opposed to a manager who is involved in doing budgets, personnel, without having a significant technical component. I've not been in that role, but I have had people working with me.
You started out, I guess, simply as a chemist, became a project scientist, a research scientist, and a group leader.
Mm-hmm.
And does each of those changes involve more responsibility, or given more responsibility?
Yeah, what happens is there's a set of grade levels we have, and the titles refer to a certain grade level with a certain aspect of responsibility. In general, as you progress up the ladder here, your span of responsibility increases, and in a way, the credibility you've established in the organization. So as you move up, the freedom to do things increases, and the sphere of the people you interact with gets to be at a different level than you might as a chemist in terms of dealing with vice presidents or operations managers and all. So it's credibility, it's responsibility, it's independence as you will.
I don't have anything beyond 78. 78, you were research associate and group supervisor, but I don't know what happened beyond that time.
All right. In 1980, I got promoted to corporate fellow.
Okay.
The two top ranks in Carbide, a fellow and then corporate fellow. A corporate fellow is equivalent to, say, an associate director. And then in 84, I got promoted to the highest rank, the technical rank there is at Carbide, which is senior corporate fellow. And that's equivalent to a major director. It's what we have grade levels as kind of a grade 19, and people major director responsibility for that. So that's kind of, that was since 1984. So we didn't become an organization, I'm unpromotable. Non-promotable. We got to change that, but I mean, so anyway, that's what it is.
Again, trying to fix some dates in mind. The first pilot plant in Texas was in 65. And at that point,
you're talking Texas. The pilot plants are in South Charleston.
I'm sorry. The prototype reactor was 68. That was in Texas.
That's in Texas. That's the first carbide fluid bed commercial reactor,
okay.
1968. Yes.
And that was primarily still HDPE and MDPE.
It was just HDPE.
Oh, just HDPE.
Just HDPE.
Okay.
68, that's HDPE. 77 is our announcement of linear low-density polyethylene. But we were actually manufacturing it a few years before, but not the really preferred grade. But in the period of the 70s, so the dates that the public is aware of is 68 and then 77 for the linear.
Yes, because I have here 72 to 74 was the pilot plant for LLDPE,
yes,
and then 75 first commercial production.
Yes, and then the announcement was in 77.
At the same time, you had one of your papers, you talked about first generation catalysts, because you talked later about second and third generation. Were these first generation catalysts the titanium magnesium catalysts, or were they chromium?
I'm not sure the context of your question. I mean,
we use those terms for so many different things. I'm not sure.
I think it was in here.
Those are the dates. That's where I pulled that.
Oh, okay. Continuous development in the first generation. Yeah. The 70 to 74 first generation chromium based catalyst.
Those are chromium.
Linear low density polyethylene. The 76 to 80 second generation for LLDPE with a titanium based catalyst.
Okay.
In this description here.
Where did the name Unipol come from? You registered as a trademark name.
It came out of our headquarters. I did not coin that name, but it's I guess it's the combination of union carbide with polyolefins, and somebody up there coined that name. I got involved in naming all the catalysts. We have our own way of describing them and all, but the description for this was done up there, and we have a number of unit stuff. We have Unival and stuff, but the Unipol thing was up there, and it was originally trademarked, and now it's registered.
This may be a trivial question, but I've seen it with all caps and with only one cap.
We continue to get guidance from law department trademark people. There's a specific protocol way for doing it. We're reminded that it's an adjective as opposed to a noun, and it should be with Unipol something this way. And we try to adhere as much as we can. I believe that it's all capitals within the registered markup, like so.
Okay.
That's how it's supposed to be done. Hopefully we all adhere to that, but sometimes but that's the way it should be. Unipol caps with
it.
And then, but it shouldn't be used alone. It's Unipol process.
Okay.
Like so, or Unipol products or something like that.
Okay.
As opposed to Unipol.
Catalyst also that you mentioned.
We're always working with another one here. We at the time I did this, it was with another catalyst. We elected for a variety of reasons not to follow through on that. It doesn't mean we're not working on. We are working on third generation, but in the context of this particular catalyst that we found. From product and process reasons, we elected not to go through and continue with these others. Although we always are looking for another generation, this one we elected not to pursue.
And the original Unipol process was joint with Shell, is that correct?
No. The Unipol process for polyethylene was carbide by itself.
Okay.
Carbide by itself. Let's see if I can get the dates right. It's probably in here. Polypropylene in here. I don't know whether this is just polyethylene. Do you have that other document? I have the date.
In this one?
Yeah. I think polypropylene. I wanted to get this published someplace in the history section because I thought it was too good, but it was written for an ACS award presentation, and when I submitted it, it had so much carbide stuff in there, it looked like it was self-serving for carbides. I thought it was a good document.
Yes,
I just couldn't get it published anywhere. Somebody said, gee, how about writing a review article? I said, well, I just gave this at the ACS thing. Why don't you use that? And the reviewers said that they didn't want to put it in because as opposed to being scientific, it was just the whole talk about carbine and things like so. It never got published, although I still think it has a lot of important information in here. Let me see if I can find that thing. I have the date. I think it's 84, something like that.
The reason I made that comment is that somewhere I remember, and that's where I have it in the note, that it sounded as if the original UNIFOL in 77 was a cooperative undertaking between carbide and Shell. And I'm not sure where I got that from.
I was trying to think the date. I think the date that we're using for UNIFOL PP is 84 or 85. I lost track of it, but I must have it in the table here someplace. Here's polyethylene. We're starting back here. This is union carbide itself. Shell is not involved until right here.
86.
Figure 9. About 85, I guess. I've forgotten. I have the date somewhere, but it's around 85. Okay. They're involved in the work here. But all of this here is all union carbide.
Okay.
Up to this point. It's only when polypropylene, but, you know, gas phase, high density, and then right about here, we're running linear low. And then licensing. See, this licensing thing is what gives this big jump up here with the facilities there. And then Shell, so it's 85.
Okay.
The other thing is that I think the dynamics, let me see if I have that slide in here. You can see the dynamics for union carbide. Here we were with all of these reactors here, and then a lot of these are high pressure reactors, like 28 reactors and a good number of pressure. And as we go and basically eliminate virtually all of them, although we do still have a little bit of high pressure, you can see we got more capacity in only 8 reactors here in terms of efficiencies, in terms of what they can do. This is very significant economic consequences in terms of operations.
This is figure 11. What is STAR?
Okay, this are two locations. We have a facility in Taft, Louisiana. We call it a STAR plant.
Okay.
And it produces, and then we have a Seadrift facility. And so those are the two production facilities for manufacturing. Okay, so it's just tipping the scale.
Okay. The original, Ziegler Natta catalysts, let's say, were 50s, early 1950s.
54. Mm-hmm.
Was there catalytic research going on in different petroleum companies in this country before that time?
Clearly there was not necessarily any research to make polyethylene. No one believed it. But there was work going on in the very early 50s, Standard Oil of Indiana and at Phelps Petroleum.
Okay.
And what happened in the early days was Phillips discovered catalyst, which is a chromium oxide catalyst, at about the same time, and maybe even a little bit earlier than Ziegler Natta had discovered polyethylene. Mid-50s, 53, 54, and the whole Ziegler Natta area merged where Phillips basically concentrated on that catalyst and were the main licensor of the catalyst back in through the 50s, and we were a licensee of Phillips. And as you know, Hogan and Banks got the Perkin Medal a few years before we did for their initial entree into this area back in that period of time, and was an impressive operation done in terms of being able to take a composition and then translate that into process. And the process that they sold was either was a combination of a solution process and a slurry process using that catalyst. In the United States, for a lot of years, that was the dominant process for making polyethylene. And in Europe, the Ziegler-Natta one was kind of the major one. Now, as time went on, we established our own identity in terms of our own proprietary catalysts. One of the problems is with the chrome ox catalyst, when you run it in a gas phase, is you can't make a whole range of products in terms of molecular weight, because the catalyst was one that basically did not have any chain transfer to hydrogen, so you couldn't control molecular weight. And Phillips spent an incredible amount of time trying to understand that phenomena for a long time so that they could control that. I mean, just a phenomenal amount of effort. And one of the things we discovered was if you go away from the chromium oxide catalyst and use this chromosine catalyst, like converting from one chromium compound to another, it allowed you to control molecularly very easy, because that catalyst had a very good hydrogen response. And was one of the main reasons we were able to make a whole variety of products back in 19. We would not have been able to run chromium oxide catalysts in a gas phase to make a whole range of products for high density if we didn't at that time have the chromosine catalyst. And so we were kind of, in a sense, competing with what was going on with chromox. And Phillips continued to study that system. And I began to recognize and have greater appreciation that the way to change the capabilities of catalytic systems is not only not just to concentrate on one, but to look at a variety of systems with different ligand structures and all. And that was a very important contribution back in 68. One of the main driving forces for why we published that paper in 72, because it showed that ligand design around catalysts is very important. And today, that is very important with other systems. The ligand design is, there's a whole family of new catalysts that are out where people are using ligand design, some of what we were using with chromium. So it's very important. And it created a sense of departure for us. And also, the Phillips process, which slurry process, when you go and you try to make the linear low-density polyethylenes, the solvent gets to be a complication because it tends to swell the polymer. And so you can't drive the density down too far. So we felt that there was a point of significant departure as you go down and put more and more branching between the original work of chromox and what we were trying to do. Although it was, as I said, Phillips was a very important contributor early technology, 1951, for many, many years. Have you talked to Hogan and Banks?
I'm supposed to see them, I think, late February. I've got a Southwest trip planned.
Yeah, I don't know whether, I think they're both retired. I know Hogan is retired, but
I've been at Phillips several times, and I know their archivist, and I've been at, they've got a very good archival collection there of material.
They seem to be conscious of history,
yes,
a bit.
Yes.
You know, I've been trying to capture that sense a little more here in Cabot on the history, but my experiences with Phillips people was that they're very conscious of that.
The corporate headquarters in Bartlesville has the second floor is totally a museum.
Oh, really?
Very, very nice.
Hmm.
All the way from the first filling station to the North Sea drilling platforms. They've done a very nice job. Mm-hmm. And they have a beautiful photographic collection, and they have a full-time archivist who does nothing but...
Oh, really?
...but maintain this collection.
Oh,
it's a good research facility. Oh. I've gotten nice documents on World War II synthetic rubber is another interest of mine, and their photograph collection is enormous.
We were... You know, one of the things I was trying to do a few years back was to take our reception area, and I said, gee, we ought to make that as more kind of thing you were talking about. And I think
we need to certainly do something in that regard more than we have. We're renovating some of the buildings, and we need to capture the sense of that more than we have in the past.
Well, another thing that's, this again is just an aside, but the American Chemical Society runs what's called a National Historic Chemical Landmarks Program, which is meant to be a grassroots movement in which nominations come in and we recognize collections and sites and products as being historical chemical landmarks. We put a plaque on the Chandler Laboratory at Lehigh and a plaque on the Priestley House in Northumberland, but now we're, in fact, I was at DuPont yesterday, the first nylon plant in Seaford, Delaware. And they're talking about building a little mini museum at the plant site, which will be open to the public, and capturing the original production of nylon, 1938. And it's working out to be very, you know, it's going to be very nice when it's done. And a lot of companies don't do that.
And I noticed that at the American Chemical, the Leo Bakelin, who was part of things here many, many years ago, also a Perkin medalist, deceased. They put the Bakelizer, which was his first reactor, is in the Smithsonian, the special branch they have.
And that was the first landmark, actually.
Yeah.
It was our first, that was to get the program kicked off. And we're working with the Hoodry process, the Sun people now, on the Hoodry process.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem with an industrial process is, where do you put a plaque? It's meant to be something that's educational for the public, and most plant sites are not available to the public. So,
certainly, the Unipol reactor, in terms of the history of chemistry and polyolefin, is certainly a major landmark. We had some, didn't they? But again, it sits in a plant site. And, can we take a break?
Oh, sure.
I just want to run to the men's room.
One of the slides, actually figure 18 in that ACS talk, you listed the factors that were present in the climate in the unipolar world, and I wondered if I'd just like to list them and have you respond to them in some specific.
Okay. Which
figure 18.
Yeah, when I did this thing, one of my intents was that when you talk technology, I think frequently we get caught up in all of the chemistry and everything without an appreciation of the atmosphere, and so my intent was to try to capture some of that.
Well, you did it very well, and
what figure did we get?
18.
Figure 18?
That's right. Yeah.
And it's figure 18 or table. I don't know.
Maybe.
I'm sure it's in here, but I have figure 18. Let me see what it's in here somewhere.
Maybe it is table 18 instead of figure.
It's probably table 18.
Because the next one is table 19, so that would be
table 18, 15, 16, 17. Yeah.
There we are.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was wondering if you could just comment on some specifics for each of these. We talked a little bit about leadership.
Okay. In the context that I was looking at, the leadership meant to me that there was leadership at the very top of the organization relative to this. There was a plan. There was motivation provided by the leadership of, we're going to do this. We're going to give you the financial support for this kind of a thing. It's very important. And I mentioned to you two particular people in very early days, John Luxinger, and then later on with Bill Joyce, who has had a very significant impact not only in this area but in all of Union Carbide in this regard. So that's what I was thinking about. But there's leadership at lower levels in terms of guiding components of the program along the line, and I think that without that enabling environment, they created an enabling environment and a financial environment to do the things. We can spend the money and do it, and we're going to get
the bureaucracy out of the way, so when we need something, we got a kind of a, in the early days, and kind of an ad hoc group that made sure that if there's something needed, you get it without going through all the bureaucracy. So that's just a half, you know, this kind of thing. Yeah, you come to a vision. The goal was that we knew right back that the industry should move in this direction. We saw that we had the lowest cost process. We saw the licensing vision. What we're going to be is a major licensor of this technology around the world. We knew we wanted to do that. We set up an organization to go and do it, and we basically did that so that it's a worldwide process, and Unipol is a word is used and known by anyone in the industry. And coming with that is commitment that it was a commitment of dollars or resources to do it. So, and it wasn't this thing that you got it for 3 to 6 months. It was a longer term commitment to provide the funding and to do it.
That's what I was going to ask. Was there ever any danger of the plug being pulled?
I think that once we got, if you go back in early 70s, when we were trying to establish some credibility for the technology, and for a while we weren't being successful, I think that we had one interesting situation. We were up for budget for the coming year, and the question was, what did you do in the past year? I'm talking now 1972 or so, haven't really seen much happening and stuff like that. So I got together with a couple of people, because we have a very small group. I said, hey, we've got to establish some credibility for this, and even if it's not all finished, we're going to go and do something. And I felt that there could have been a period at that time where if we weren't going to demonstrate something soon, we might lose resources, so maybe this isn't viable. But I think once we got beyond 77, nobody was going to pull the plug. We knew we had what we wanted. Before that, we didn't. But we had what would amount to a very specialty business. But after that, 77, it was just a question of just putting the manpower guns in to do this kind of thing.
Do you think that people like Joyce serve to insulate you from those above them? You say they were the leaders, but they had to account for somebody else.
Yeah. Sure. There, I'm sure for a period of time, there was always this question of whether you should be moving more towards specialties as opposed to commodities. And there's a whole mindset of, gee, you're never going to make any money. And we used to have a ranking of businesses, and for a while the polyethylene wasn't at the top by any matter of means, because it was viewed as cyclical. You made money for 1 year, and then you lost money for a bunch of years, and then you made money, and how the hell can you run a business like that? And what happened was, when you put the licensing business in to this whole thing, we have a steady income, a base income, so that it's bringing that in, and then you can ride the cyclicality, the rest, using the licensing income for that. So that change of perspective on this kind of thing. But yeah, I think that we had done what we did at Unipol, we would not even be in polyethylene today. And I think that a lot of the business aspect of this thing relative to commitment and selling the management on this, the board of directors and all, had to be very difficult. Tom Thompson, who was Joyce's boss, was also, I think, important in terms of being a supporter of committed to this thing. And again, he
he was on the same wavelength as Joyce was in terms of and then you always had the people of licensing versus not licensing. You know, why would you give this away to anybody? Why would you by doing that? And there's a whole mindset that had to be changed, and no doubt there was resistance. And so they paved the way.
Willard Dow said in the World War II styrene development project, actually pre-World War II, he said it was an example of patient money and a prayerful attitude. Mm. And it seems to sum up a lot of things very...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There's just so many times... You know, it came out so many different times in a technical setting that you're at a point where you need to do something to demonstrate some credibility, so you go and you take more risks than you might think because you need to demonstrate a point because you're at a point where... And if you look at just the lab data we had at the time we went and scaled it up, and just look at the raw data, there's no justification to do that run at all. But what tended to happen was that in that different gas-based setting than what we were doing in the laboratory, we got an improved performance. And it turned out that those improved performances were due to some factors that we didn't recognize at that time, that they actually disappeared later on, but we'd already gotten by that hurdle. I got some more. You know, so we kind of were lucky. You know, I have at the bottom the last item here, which is luck. You work in an environment, and as a result of that, you want certain things to happen. And you go back in hindsight and say, gee, if this had happened and that had happened in this way, then we may not have had this. And even in the commercial setting, if we hadn't done things in a certain sequence that we had done, it's unlikely that we would have had the credibility to do this. But, you know, I guess luck comes to people who are out there willing to take chances and do some things. But we've had several circumstances where we were very lucky in just how things fell into place. So I guess I covered this can-do attitude. You know, my feeling and the whole attitude feeling of the people involved was, yeah, we can do this kind of a thing. It's a lot of work, but it can be done. We certainly were focused. You know, when you come up with a new area, there's about 20 different ways you can go, and I think it was important to, at all levels, to focus in on exactly what we wanted to achieve. We put the resources on it. We moved resources. We took people. Here's a whole existing business in high pressure. We took people out of high pressure, put them into our local school, even at the risk that maybe those whole business might not run quite as well. They said if there's an emergency, they'll have them there. But we're moving out of that area, so let's go and move these people. So a number of the people that ended up working in this area were people that hadn't worked in the old technology before.
I think we had some good people, outstanding people. I think there was a lot of creativity in terms of people being allowed to use imagination. And like in any large industrial organization, there's a lot of teamwork going on. Everyone wanted to make the thing work. Kind of fun to change the... It's kind of fun to be in a situation where you got to change the industry around. Guys have been doing this thing for 30, 40 years. And not only change it around, but this industry is so huge. I mean, you're not dealing with 50 or 100 pounds. You're dealing with billions of pounds of material. The world's largest amount of plastic, and you're making it by an entirely new process. It's kind of different. And so it's kind of fun to, you have a sense that there's some history will remember this when you get all finished, because it is the industry. And I understand in some of courses in business technology, some of the big business schools, Unipol was cited as an example of technology. The guy at Kinsey Associates, what's his name, Foster, used to go around about tech people. His attitude was that generally when there's new technology coming out, it comes out
It was kind of an interesting case. We were even attacking our own technology. It seems to be a little bit different than what we normally.
So, well, you changed the whole economics drastically.
Oh, yeah. Very significant is just the cost of the equipment to run under the conditions and the maintenance. And as I said, for a number of the products, they're better. Now, some of the products are still better by the high pressure valve, and we are developing, we think that as time goes on, some of those will give way as well. I don't know how much construction of high pressure stuff has taken place since 1977, but in Jeremiah.
That covers that list, I guess.
There is one question I wanted to, we're going to look at table 19 also, the one right after that. But before we do, this whole concept of teamwork, there are some people who prefer to be loners, research environment, and how do you identify people who are team players?
It's funny, when we have... I have new people come in, and I kind of make a judgment just from talking to them as to, gee, this person will be good in doing research in the laboratory. And then I had a fellow come in, looking back some years ago, where I said, gee, he would be very good in an interface role, and we'll get him involved in our pilot scale activities in the plant. So, in my own case, I kind of make some judgment of what I see in a person. You know, we try them out and see how well they work. As far as the loners are concerned, if a person functions in that category, it's fine. What I just want them to do is to have an appreciation for the fact that just because they're doing research in a laboratory doesn't mean that stuff is 1,000 times more. There's a mindset, gee, you need to understand what these other people are doing. And even though you do this and do it in the loan or be an individual contributor, you ought to understand the context of the work that you're doing, because ultimately the work you're going to do is going to have some impact into the organization. You need to understand what the rest of the organization's about. Mm-hmm. But they may still go back. So some people do better doing the laboratory work, although I must say that a lot of people like the interfaces that occur, particularly if they got their own little thing that they're doing and they don't want to have to carry it with them so that everybody does it right. We don't really have much of a problem with people interfacing with power facility. Now, some people do it better than others, and some are more conscious of this kind of thing. But, I guess it's built into what we're doing. We operate in such a way that people come in, they kind of just get involved in that kind of thing. But and if a person is a loner and does it, that's okay, provided he has at least a little education.
Okay, table 19, are some other generalities about the Unipol process, the wedding of many technologies.
Catalysts, process, fabrication, stabilization, all of these things all need to be integrated so that what you end up calling a Unipol thing is a combination of a number of disciplines. The discipline of purification of the monomer, the purification of reaction rates, the construction of the facilities, ways of making catalysts. I guess what I'm trying to say here is there's about a whole string of pieces, all of which together, in order to make what's called uniform. owes existence to Team Effort. Incredible amount of work going on between engineering, manufacturing, R&D. We don't talk to each other. No way we're ever going to get this thing to go. That's what that means. Many inventions here. We set out back when we were doing this thing to cover the aspects of the catalyst, the aspects of its manufacture, the actual operation of the fluid bed, and we have patents and know-how on a lot of these aspects of this thing, and so we can look at those. And I guess the bottom one, important contributions by many investigators, a lot of creative people doing things, and you always run into the issues of individual recognition of those group efforts and there's the balance and this kind of thing. So I wanted to acknowledge that here I am, I'm giving this award in an ACS, and I didn't want to leave the message that, hey, I'm doing all of this by myself, because that is not the case. And that's what that was all about, and to try to, and I spent a little bit of time emphasizing that, both from a management point of view. You give awards to an individual, but in an industrial context, this is a hell of a lot of people. So that's what that's about.
Whose name was on, were on some of the crucial catalyst patents? Whether it was it your name and many others, or
it's a spectrum. There's a series. If you look at key patents, there are some with me and maybe one other person. Some have five or six names on them. There may be some where I've just got my name on the thing. The names are scrambled all over the place. And some of them, another person's name is, you know, there seems to be concern sometimes about first names on patents and so forth. Our attitude on this thing is we scramble them all over the place. We tried alphabetical for a while, and then we ended up with just a whole spectrum of different approaches, and the intent was, my intent in cases there, because I told the attorneys in a lot of cases, I gave them guidance as to how to put them, is to not create it as a one-man show. So we reverse names on many of the patents, so you'll see the names. So the answer is that some have just one or two, and in some cases there can be five or six, particularly ones that involve the interface between the laboratory and the pilot plant, where we're contributing a piece and the pilot plant's contributing a piece to make it go. There's lots of discussion going on, and in those cases there can be a number of people, because each one is contributing to me some aspect of it. So it varies.
What was the size of the Unipol team, approximately?
At what level? At what time?
At the time when, 77, let's say, when it was ready to go.
Let's go back a little bit before that. In 73 and 74, in the laboratory, the effort in this area involved one person, one fellow and I, working on the laboratory. And there was one process person and a supervisor down in Charleston, and maybe a couple of product people. So you're talking about in 73, 74, anywhere from two to six people, depending on what particular year. But on the laboratory effort, we just had one person in the lab looking at the stuff. And from that effort to where we are today, where we have lots and lots of people. I mean, I don't have a count, but it's certainly huge compared to where we started off with just a few people in 73, 74. The critical thing was we looked for new catalysts, because we felt that was about to get to these new materials,
And we did that work in 75, 76, and we still weren't sure whether they're going to work. We went to the pilot plant, and in 76, I guess it was, when we ran and made those runs and evaluated the product, and we knew as soon as we saw the product that we had what we wanted, the effort went up very rapidly from just a few people to a huge effort. And Unipol just became all kinds of things to we have hundreds of people in R&D today that are associated one way or another with Unipol. Big change.
So it is the business which keeps the company afloat, which is
it's probably the most I think it's the most significant business in Union Carbide today. It certainly is a worldwide business, and we are presently going into, we have a number of joint ventures that are going on. We have one that just trying to complete now with Unichem in Italy. We have one with Autochem in France. We have a huge arrangement in Kuwait, and the intent there is to put an ethylene cracker in to get the ethylene and to use that ethylene, the Unipol process, and glycol. So glycol and polyethylene are two huge businesses, and so the polyethylene is doing very well with the licensing. And we have huge facilities in Saudi Arabia, and there's a number of there. So we're having a entree into Europe now, and in the whole context of Union Carbide, we went also at the same time from about 100,000 employees down to about 13,000 employees. So the whole nature of the company has changed. There's lots of business areas that Carbide was in. They've been spun off. Praxair was spun off. Some of them were sold. We've gotten out of some businesses and all. And so we're truly a chemicals and plastics company now, where in the past we were involved in all kinds of different things. Carbon products, as I said, and consumer products and all. So, and what we're focused in is businesses of which Unipol is the major business today for Union Carbide. So it's a huge change, and it's the reason why I think all of those actions, as well, our attitude is we want to have credible technology where we have the leading technology, and we certainly believe in this area where we have the leading technology. And we think we're going to do whatever we can to continue to reinforce and support.
The next thing I'd like to look at is some comments you made in your Perkin address, which you titled The Roots of Innovation.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about how you define innovation already.
Uh-huh.
You said it depends on teamwork, and we've already talked about teamwork.
Uh-huh.
You also said that innovation depends on a strong marketing network.
We've established that we have a process that can make a set of products. These products are different. They're different than high-pressure ones. They happen to be better in a number of applications, but the fact that they're different, we had to educate people that different wasn't a deficiency but an asset. These materials fabricated somewhat different than the high-pressure material. We needed to go out and convince people that changing the extrusion behavior of this would be of benefit to them, and they eventually did it. So what I'm addressing here is the status quo of, gee, this is what we got today, why are you coming in with something like this, and how do you educate the people as you create what we call a polyethylene revolution? People just aren't going to take it because since it's made by a different process, and even though, as I said earlier, the improvements, public had to be receptive to that. You know, and I think that's characteristic in general when you come up with something that's different. The initial reaction is, who needs you? You're creating problems for me, and as opposed to an opportunity. So that's what I meant by the marketing aspect.
Well, and that there was another aspect which is tied to that, and that is learning to listen to what the customer wants. I think the chemical industry has changed a lot from the old days in which we have, here we are making all this chlorine, you come and get it, to now realizing that you have to be more perceptive and maybe go the other way around, develop something for a customer's needs, mm-hmm. instead of finding a customer to buy what product you're making.
Yeah. I think the whole industry has changed in that regard in terms of customer focus, in terms of understanding what they're saying, what are they really trying to tell you, to listen to that. And I think that that has been a whole change in the whole industry about that question, as you had mentioned. So I thought it was important to capture that aspect in the presentation.
You also talked about innovation being motivated by fear, that is competition.
You know, we're in an industry, there's a lot of people out there. Everybody's working to try to develop something new and different. I think the last thing you can try to do is be complacent, assume that you're sitting at the peak. In fact, if you think you're at the peak, you probably ought to be running as hard as all, because there's a bunch of guys that have got you targeted to knock you off the peak. So I think that it's an important concept to recognize that you're not alone in the world, and people are going to compete with you. And if you stand still and you don't do anything, so you want to get out there. And I think things are going well, you probably ought to run with as much fear as any. I think that's a very important concept, as opposed to polishing the sails on the sailing ships, because no one's going to have a better one, and then you find out somebody's got something entirely different.
As part of that competition, or the increased competition, come from post-World War II activities, and now it's the industry's global as opposed to concentrated in a few countries?
Yeah, I'm struck. Recently I've had an opportunity to be in a number of different countries in Europe and in Asia, Japan, China. There's big things happening there. The competition that you see emerging. I was struck just recently by a trip to China and seeing the amount of construction going on. The people seem to be very active in terms of the motivation from what I saw. And I think that we have to recognize what's happening in this country. Now, we have a number of projects specifically in China today. We're building a number of beautiful processes. But understanding the people and the culture and what they're trying to do, and how do you adjust to their desire to be fully competitive is right. I mean, there's a whole different kind of people that need to be out there understanding that, not only from a management point of view, but what are the technology things that are happening there. And we have cases where we put in units over there, we're struck by the dedication that some of the people putting into getting those units built up and running quickly, and many of them do a very fine job in doing that. But as time goes on, there'll be competition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of stuff happening around the world.
Well, the other side of the coin is, you also said, in addition to motivation by fear, another motivation was the fact that it was fun.
Oh, yeah. People, when they're working on something that they think the company cares about, are willing to put resources in, you can kind of take your own individual approach on that and kind of tinker with the whole business arena. People like that kind of stuff. I think the discouraging thing is if you're starting working on a particular project and there's no funding 6 months later for the thing, just as you think it's just starting to get started on the thing. It's, it seemed to me that the threat of pulling the plug within 6 months on a project is it's not as much fun as working in an area where you think you're doing something that's important, management cares about it, it's scientifically interesting. It's kind of a big combination of things. And so that was what it was. And people like that, and they have some fun playing around with that.
Well, as long as it's fun for the people who are doing it, you get a lot more productivity at the same time.
Yeah, it's a fragile thing. You have to be careful that what might be fun for you, you need to be sure that for the individuals that are actually involved, you know, a lot of the very specifics there, they have the same kind of fun as you think you're having. Because, and that's something you have to watch out for. You know, so that I think climate, atmosphere, enabling environment in which people are working is critical in terms of things. And I think sometimes monitoring just what that environment is, you think you've created, hey, I created this environment, you find out maybe it isn't really that environment, is a touchy issue that needs to affects motivation. So it needs to be monitored. But people at the time we were originally doing this work were just a very intense level of motivation. And then you tend to go into phases that tend to be more consolidation, where you kind of consolidate your gains so you, before you take your next plateau. So you kind of go through plateaus here of demonstrating, consolidating, reinventing and things.
You listed a few factors that would help you identify potential innovators. And one of those factors was people who were in a hurry.
Yeah, a sense of urgency. I think that's important. Research that we get involved with, there's so many things you can do. You can go and study a piece of this thing forever, and you can do it in the sense that, gee, if I do this, I can publish, maybe publish a number of papers in this area, and there's no sense of timing in terms of the fact that whether I get it done this week or next week is all that important. And what we were trying to capture is that we're in a race with other people, other countries, and they're not taking that attitude. They're out there, they want to make something happen. So you got to be in a hurry, a sense of urgency, this timing. Time is very important between initial, first establishing initial discovery and taking advantage of it. You ought to treat it as an urgent thing. It have to have happen. You know, why does it take 7 to 10 years to commercialize something? Why can't we do it sooner? What creates a sense of urgency in terms of doing this kind of thing?
Another factor of identifying potential innovators was people who had an independent spirit.
Just because I go to somebody and say, okay, you want to do this, and you might want to look at it this way, I mean, it doesn't mean that they got to go and do it that way. You want to get an answer. And frequently when you go there's always people who say, hey, I don't know how to get there, I know how to do it. You got to create that atmosphere so that while we all have the same objective, maybe there are pathways there to create. The idea is that, gee, you're smart enough to figure out some other things. And there's always people that, no matter what, how you tell them you want to do it, just because the supervisor told them they want to do it another way. you want to be sure that they have that opportunity to look at some other things. Frequently, those things are better ways than what you thought about. They had longer to think about.
That's what that is about. As opposed to say, okay, I'll do it, and how do you want me to do it? Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
And the last one was something I liked. You said that potential innovators were people who see difficulty as a challenge, not as a roadblock.
Yeah. I think kind of speaks for itself. I think people, good people, like significant challenges, and they want to go and do it. And they like to look at those obstacles, and they look at those perceived obstacles as something for them to go in and just push out of the way, and as opposed to, this is too difficult, I don't want to get involved in this kind of thing, I want to make it something. And, you know, even in terms of people's accomplishments, you know, a person can list a lot of the things that they've done at the end of the year. The question you always face is, are they very difficult? And so you get somebody that's listed 10 accomplishments during the year, and you look at it and say, gee, why did it take you so long to do those 10? This other guy has been working, and maybe he's only overcome one, but that one was so significant that it dwarfs the others, and that's an important thing. In looking at people, what are you asking them to do? Are you giving them, an easy job, or is it something really significant? That's what that means.
You also said that innovation can be messy and disorderly.
There's no structure in the early stages of this kind of thing. You know, as I look around and you're groping, you have some ideas, you think you want to do it this way, you try it, it doesn't work. A couple other guys, they got better ways to do it, and I need to probe it. So you go through a period of time where the initial demonstration of credibility for something involves a creative interplay of one or several people. And to have a person fail once or twice or not have rational explanations for everything he's doing is part of how this happens. I think there's a risk in creating too much structure to this thing too early in this thing, because I think that's not the nature of the thing. And I think I worry a bit about that one, because I think there is frequently an attempt to put lots of structure and order into a process that's inherently disorderly. I've seen it a number of times, and I've seen how it works. And preserving that perspective on being messy and disorderly, not for its sake of being messy, that's just the nature of the thing. I'm not sure how much you want to systematize this kind of thing. I constantly have interactions with a number of my engineering friends who tend to be more structured and more than I thought I might be. In fact, the reason we're here, rather than my office is disorderly. I don't have a lot of room for you to sit for us to talk. I don't know whether that's a good sign or a bad sign. But I do think that there is a process here that goes on where the innovators are now, the people who have made inventions are now trying to go through the innovation process. And it's amorphous, it's squishy, there's not much structure. But I think the thing that drives it is the motivation. I think it's the perception that it's there, and you need to get there. You go through that phase. And so, well, you know, I guess you can't endorse chaos. I think what I'm trying to say is, it's there. And I think the thing I've said to all the people who work with me is, you never let ignorance prevent you from making progress. You know what I'm saying? Is we do things, and sometimes you don't have all the answers because you don't even know the right questions to ask. But we got to try this or that kind of thing. And don't let the fact that you don't know everything about it disturb you from going the next step. But if you, because in the process of getting all of the information, the parameter you're playing with is time, and it can take you an awful lot of time to do all of that.
And I think there's a balance between having a certain amount of information. Now, my philosophy is not universally acceptable to everybody, but I mean, that's kind of how I see the thing, how I've operated, at least with some success.
And I think we've already talked about this, but you might want to comment some more. One of the other things you said about innovation is that it involves risk.
If you're going to go and do something different, you're sticking your neck out to a certain extent because you don't know how the hell some of these things are going to happen.
And you're going to find as you go and you do them that things didn't work out. And you got to be able to accept that, and somebody asks you, well, how come this isn't working, and why are you spending so much time vegan? You got to be able to be prepared to do that. Lots of people are not risk, most people really aren't risk takers, and really, because and I think you have to do that in order to do something new and different. And you're going to stub your toe, and you got to be prepared to do that. And I think that if there's an enabling environment, and by that I mean there's an enabling environment at the top of the organization that says this is so important, we recognize that there's going to be some risk associated with this, and we're prepared to work with you and that kind of thing, it's okay. Otherwise, you're just making small incremental changes that aren't typical. And you always stay in the same box. If you got a boss, you got to take some risks. Sometimes you get put in the penalty box, and sometimes you don't, depending on what happens.
That's good. You essentially spent your entire career working on catalysts.
Yeah,
did you ever get tired of that? Did you ever wish that you could go off to a totally new area and start something else?
Well, I've always, when you say you worked your whole area in catalysis, and that is true, but when you look at it from an R&D point of view, what we're doing in catalysis involves a lot of things. It involves the synthesis of exotic organometallics. It involves interfaces with a lot of different things. It involves worldwide interactions with people in this process as a business. So I interface with a lot of different people in a lot of different areas. So I don't look at it as, gee, you're working catalysis in a laboratory with the door closed every day. That's not what I do. And so I happen to play around a lot, with catalysts, but the exposure you get and the result of that, I think, makes the job worthwhile. So I'm involved in that.
Any memorable frustrations or setbacks or failures along the way?
Oh, yeah. You go back and try and establish credibility for these kind of things. There are a number of times where we've done things and they haven't worked. There's been frustration along that line.
How do you deal with that?
I guess my own dealings with this is to continue to plow ahead. People have made those comments, but at the same time, they haven't. We haven't gone the process of, you need somebody else to do this kind of thing. So you're allowed to redeem yourself from some of these kinds of things. There's always organizational changes that occur to any big organization, some of which you think are good, some of them you think should not have occurred, and you kind of have to grapple with that over a period of time in terms of what you would have expected
I think the thing that is always the biggest issue is when you're in circumstances where you don't feel you can control your own fate. That's the worst thing to me that can happen. But being not control your own fate, things occur in organizations where you feel you should be part of that process, and things occur when you're not part of that process and you have to take the outcome of that and they affect what you do. Those kinds of circumstances are always difficult ones for me to deal with. When I feel I'm in control of my own fate in terms of making organizations or doing things, I feel I can overcome the things. But in big organizations, there's always situations where there's frustration because there's so many people involved in so many different parts of the thing that impact on you that people you figure that's not the way that should be done, and if you can't control it, that's bad. And I think organizations need to grapple with that as opposed to individuals with sensitivities of that type. The human resources, human relations aspects always get to be a part in any organization, even there for a while, as to what you perceive as the best things to do and what the organization perceives as the best things. And sometimes they don't match sometimes. Some of those are difficult ones for me. But I guess the thing that saves you in those kind of things is that you can get involved enough in the details of the work that you can write it out, some of those. Where if you didn't have something that was challenging and interesting, then it'd be more difficult to do this kind of thing. So those are always, always difficult ones. Organization, how do we best do the thing? How is organizations change and people, new people get involved and they see things? And you always have, I guess it's almost a dinosaur complex where you kind of look at things and you say, gee, we never did it that way before, why are we doing it that way now? It worked this way, and why are you telling me what's your experience base that said it's going to be any better? And there's two parts to that. Just because you did it that way before doesn't mean it's right now, but on the other hand, there's the whole issue of, gee, you ought to and that's part of the history and the chemistry in a way is, how does an organization preserve what it knows are good things to do, a way to operate, a way to think, a way to do things, and how do you transfer that to people in an organization? And are they even going to be receptive to that because they see things differently? And I think that's the big challenge in an organization, to preserve its creativity and its identity as an organization changes. It's be a whole study in its own, I think, a very interesting
one. Yes. I think personality has, I don't know how you define personality, but it's sort of an innate kind of thing. And if you have the right mix of personalities, it can be tremendous in terms of what you can get done. And if you don't have the right mix, it doesn't mean that the people aren't competent. It's just that
it's not the right.
It's just doesn't the right combination. It doesn't work.
Absolutely. And over time, I see that, and I see how the things have changed. And you know, I've been in Carbine a good many years, I think I understand what makes things work and what is effective. But I must say that as I see other people coming in and looking at it differently, there's always the tension that gets created as a result of that because I frankly don't agree. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been down that road. And I have to balance that with, am I always right?
That's a hard question to answer.
My wife knows I'm not.
We've covered pretty much all of what I had on the agenda that I had sent you. Mm-hmm. Just a couple little loose ends, I think. One was, how much interaction did you have with peers outside of the company?
In my area of discipline, yeah. I know most of the people that work in the area. year, I attend a major industrial, major international symposium, which involves academics. I normally, for a number of years now, will give a presentation on some aspect of uniform technology. So we fund research at a number of universities, not only U.S., but you know, the funding I give for this year, I give some money to a fellow in Poland,
right,
in southern Poland. Been over there, visited with him. He's doing a kind of work that I think is very interesting. I have some money in my budget, and I give him some money. $15,000, not a tremendous amount, but he has some funding. They'll love it.
And oh, good, sure, relationship.
Sure. I have interfaces and people in Korea, and we're all over the world, and we paid a visit to Novosibirsk, which is in Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
So my attitude about interfaces is very important. I try to go to meetings each year. Generally, they're international meetings. I think I know all of the major players in the world personally, one way or another, because I work at it. You know, it's because I do go there, and we do have discussions. I work at it, and in addition, the Unipol process creates an environment for people to come and talk where they might not do that as a result of that. So it's a combination of what's happened as well as being present at the meetings. And I found it good, very informative, and background. So, in my general area of discipline, I know a good many people.
What changes have there been at Carbide over the years you've been here in the company's attitude towards supporting R&D or towards R&D and what they expected from it?
I think the support in the area I'm involved with, I can't speak for all of Carbide, but certainly in the area I've been involved with, the support for other things has been fantastic, really has been. In fact, some years ago, we would request an increase in the number of people, and we might ask for two or three additional people. The question is, how come you're not asking for five or six?
Wow.
Which is an unbelievable circumstance. We're looking right now at getting some additional help in computational chemistry. I have a budget for this year, and I've already got the manpower in there, and I basically said, I think we need to look at one of, we'll look at one of these fellows, but if we hire him, we go over a budget. Is that okay? Yeah, that's okay. It's unique. It's a truly a unique environment. In fact, a lot of the rules that I think are in textbooks don't even apply. And I tell it to people, you know, in a historical in the organization as perceived, people sort of say, gee, I really got to sell this project to my management, so I really got to be optimistic and all. We almost have a reverse situation where the management has already said that they're going to accept that. You better be sure that you're responsible in what you're recommending.
Okay.
And it's kind of interesting from what historically you might read as to what's really happening in our own area. As opposed to why aren't you helping the business that's going on? Why aren't you doing more new things? And why aren't you requesting funds to do more of that and no other proposal? So I think it's attributed to the environment. I must say that, Bill Joyce in particular is a unique individual who encourages a lot of that and kind of just cascades through the organization. So he certainly been a true supporter of R&D as well to put funding at times even beyond what you might request. So that's very good.
In your opinion, what is important for the future of R&D in the chemical industry? The number of segments has declined, and
well, certainly,
certainly the recognition by management that R&D is a vital link to the future is the key to the whole thing. Having a vision of where they want to go that they can convey to the R&D organization, where you want to be 10 years from now, what kind of businesses do you see yourself wanting to be in, which areas you want to be number one in, and convey that to us. What's your strategy?
There's been lots of discussion in the last few years about strategy. What is it? Does everyone have a strategy? Lots of work going on that kind of thing. And recognize that the R&D requires certain kinds of tools and facilities and capabilities to be able to kind of provide those things. So it's strategy, it's focus, vision, and trust, I guess, in R&D that they'll be able to do some things, right? And this, as opposed to, gee, we can never trust you guys to do anything. I mean, and this ebbs and flows on that kind of thing. I think there's high levels of credibility, and you go through areas of less than high credibility. And that's the nature of the kind of thing we're doing it. I think the management that recognizes that, is willing to do that, is going to be the management that's going to succeed. I think that it's important, just something to worry about is to be sure that in organizations, as people leave organizations, new people come in, to have a conscious way of maintaining the things that work well and not. I think we need to do some more things in that regard so that people understand. We can change the way you do R&D, we're going to do these kinds of things. You need in the process to recognize what did work and what doesn't work, because when you're in a system that looks good, but if it doesn't really do the thing and really is effective, you have to avoid bureaucracy as much as you can. I think it's always the tend to systematize and organize. You can't be against that kind of thing, but you have to recognize the environment. I go to Italy, and I have a lot of friends at some of the companies over there. Not a hell of a lot of organization I can see over there. People are immensely creative in terms of things that they come up with. And you have to ask, you know, what's the right way of doing things here? Is it in joint ventures? Teach us a lot, because you start working with other cultures. How do they do things? And the challenge for us in our area is we're going into a lot of joint ventures with lots of people working with Shell, and we're working with this company, that company. And how do you take what's good in what they do in music? And how do you carry out joint research programs? And I think this, for us, that's a big challenge for us.
And one last question, and that is, what did it mean to you to win the Perkin Medal?
You know, I got a lot of awards over a period of time, but in a way it's a special award, the Perkin Medal. First, I think the ceremony really is an individual ceremony. It's done with great class. It's probably, and I certainly appreciate it that way. It made me feel good in the sense that, gee, this is an important award in the United States. It's one for which I'm here. What I felt was the reason why I'm here in an organization, and for the industry to say, yeah, you're really special in regard to what we think you've done, it's about as good a feeling as you can have as working in the kind of stuff we do. So I have a very warm spot in my heart for this particular award.
Is there anything that I haven't covered that you'd like to add to this at this point?
Not that I can think of. It was, I don't know, to a certain extent, I guess I kind of rambled on, and I guess I'm not clear how this all gets consolidated. But I felt good. You like to feel as though you've accomplished something, somebody cares about it, that you've had an impact. And I just appreciated the opportunity to be in an environment that we can do that and do something that, for me, is important, that somebody cares about the industry and the challenge. You know, from my point of view, having an enormous challenge to try to go and do something and then see an organization and work as part of that organization to see it happen is about why I came to work in the first place. So it's kind of satisfying.
Well, okay, and then with that, I'll thank you again very much for spending the morning with me. I've enjoyed it.
Would you like to go to lunch?
All right.
There's a little Italian place just up the road away.